From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Protesters are still congregating today outside the police station in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, the site last night of protests over the death of Dante Wright, who police say was accidentally shot with a gun an officer mistook for her taser.
Dante Wright!
Today, about 10 miles away, it's day 12 of the murder trial of Derek Chauvin and the death of George Floyd. Closing arguments are expected to start as soon as next week. NPR's David Shaper is in Minneapolis. David, what do you want us to know about the trial today?
Well, today the prosecution rested its case, and now it's the defense team's turn. The defense has quite a job on its hands, too, because they have to counter 2 weeks of witnesses for the prosecution, witnesses that included top police officials and experts in police training who explained that Chauvin did not follow proper police protocols when he put his knee on the back of George Floyd's neck for almost 9.5 minutes, and that the restraint that he used was not a means that the police follow, at least not anymore. There were medical experts saying that it was that force on Floyd's neck that likely caused his death. And there was also the emotional testimony of witnesses to the incident and from Floyd's family. So the defense is first going to focus on trying to counter that strong narrative that the prosecution presented for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and from watching this trial, people in the area were already tense. And then the temperature just shot right up after the death of Dante Wright on Sunday.
Right.
He tried to flee police after a traffic stop, and the officer who fired on him says on a brutal audio tape that so many people have now seen, holy expletive, I shot him. So what more first are you learning about the investigation into the shooting death?
Well, the medical examiner did determine that it was a homicide, that it was a gunshot wound to the chest that killed Dante Wright. There is an ongoing investigation into the shooting and why it was that the officer may have mistakenly grabbed her firearm instead of the taser. They're also looking into the circumstances of what led up to the stop. The police say that Dante Wright was stopped because he had expired tags on his license plates, and that they ran a background check and realized that there was an outstanding warrant for a prior failure to appear in court on some other charges. I'm sure they'll review the entire thing in terms of how the situation escalated to the point it did and got out of hand. So it continues, it's still a very tense situation as a result.
Right. And the trial continues, too. So both of these things going on simultaneously
right.
in this area. To the trial, what will you be watching for in the days ahead?
I think the thing that the defense wants to do with the first couple of witnesses, in fact, we do know that the first couple of witnesses have already taken the stand, that it's a former Minneapolis police officer who is involved in an arrest of George Floyd a year prior to the incident in which he was killed, in which he ingested some drugs
yeah.
and apparently became a little bit combative. Also, the paramedic who treated him in that incident. And I think they're going to try to lay a foundation that that Floyd's state made that use of force necessary.
NPR's David Shaper, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
While we're hearing about the unrest in Minnesota, perhaps just as many people gathered overnight to grieve the loss of life and the sustained trauma of reliving the death of George Floyd during this Derek Chauvin trial, let's catch up with Kino Evall. He's the founder of Black Table Arts, a co-op of Black artists in Minneapolis. It's been a place where people are connecting with each other to process what's happening there. Kino, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty okay. There's a lot of moving pieces in the city right now, but within the work that I'm doing of gathering Black artists, it's still a joy to do it in collaboration with other great collectives too, so I'm good.
Your co-op, Black Table Arts, is being used as the space to help people there process their trauma and grief. What does the processing of grief at Black Table Arts look and sound like?
Absolutely. You know, one of my favorite writers, Fred Moten, says the only way to protect joy is to practice it. And the way that we've been practicing that joy is through a community event series called We Got Us. That's in collaboration with some phenomenal orgs, True Roots, Catalyst Arts, Rare Production, and the Million Artists Movement. That happens on Mondays and Thursdays. And we have some great events coming up. No Future Without Art, which is a two-day training for Black artists who want to plug into grassroots organizing. And then we do Black Lives Matter bi-weekly, which is a writing workshop for Black poets. So we protect our joy by practicing the Black togetherness that just comes up in community work, in community organizing. And so that sort of conviviality of getting people together and just, you know, saying, let's think about what the poem has to say. Let's think about what the artist has to say about the kind of future that we want to live in. And so our sort of processing is through gatherings, through let's saying, let's still get together and let's think through the ideas and let's think through the tactics that are available to us. So we process by mm-hmm. gathering, by thinking through ideas, by getting together, and by affirming that joy simply just by practicing it.
Well, Kino, part of what you are is a long line of ancestors who used collective joy to get through really difficult times. Mm-hmm. But in America, the killing of Black men and women by police officers can feel inescapable, almost inevitable. Are you angry?
I mean, of course, right? I mean, it's perpetual sort of unwarranted violence visited upon people you care about and some strangers you don't know, right? Like, you know, we may not have personally known George Floyd, but it's the reminder of the face and of the skin and of the a voice that reminds us of people we do care about. So it's this sort of relationality, even in the context of a stranger, that sparks that solidarity, right? It makes us answer the question, what kind of society do we want to live in? And artists respond with empathy. They say the kind of society that I want to live in is one of communalism, of one where the people who serve and protect us don't actually hurt us. So who within our lives actually serve and protect us that live by that motto, right? And then the poet says, oh, it's my grandmother, or oh, it's mm-hmm. my uncle, or it's my, you know, it's someone that I already recognize, right? So that's that sort of poetic imagination, is to recognize these alternatives when the conditions may say that there are no alternatives. The poet, the dancer, the painter says, I have one, and I express it through my art, right? So artists remind us that other realities can be authorized in spite of these conditions. But yeah, no, it's frustrating. It's, you know, yeah, there's definitely anger, of course. But again, we respond with a sort of collective solidarity that keeps that momentum in the movement.
Mm. You're also a poet. Is there a particular line or poem that you've been turning to recently or that has come up for mm-hmm. you over these last few weeks?
Absolutely. One of my favorite poets, Suzanne Cesaire, and it's actually written on the walls of our cooperative. It's the revolution will construct itself in the name of bread, of course, but also in the name of fresh air and of poetry, which often amounts to the same thing. And she was a poet writing that during World War I. Between World War I and World War II, Suzanne Cesaire. And that quote, again, speaks to the nature of poetry. We need art. We need poetry, particularly in times of despair, because the despair won't have the last word. We will keep the last word for ourselves, and we will find that in community, and we will have fun and protect this joy by practicing it. And we can have this kind of Black joy without anxiety or paranoia. And for us in South Minneapolis, that looks like a little cooperative. Mm-hmm. And that space is one where you can just enjoy the sunlight through the windows, and you can listen to music, and you can write a poem, and you can find new friends, and you could just hang out along with the grassroots efforts, right? Along with the community building, so.
How are you preparing for the end of the trial, for the verdict?
Yeah, that's a good question. Self-care and, you know, Tony K. Bambara has this quote, "Not all speed is movement," to say, don't assume that because you're moving quickly that you're building power. So I've been trying to slow down. And it's easier said than done as an organizer. Like, I say that quote a lot. But to actually be in the practice of slowness and grace. But yeah, that's what I've been trying to do is wake up a little bit slower, go to work a little bit slower. And some days I'm good at that. And some days I fall short. But I've just been trying to enjoy the sunlight through the windows and take my time and practice grace. And my friends hold me accountable to that. So,
Kino Ebal is founder of Black Table Arts, a co-op for Black artists in Minneapolis. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a joy.
The Fox drama The Resident returns from hiatus tonight with the return of Malcolm Jamal Warner as A.J. Austin, a surgeon who falls in love with a colleague, played by Shaunette Renee Wilson.
We are both passionate and opinionated people, inside and outside of the operating room.
So we need ground rules.
Exactly. Inside these walls, we keep it strictly professional at all times.
Agree. No physical contact of any kind.
Well, we can table that part of the discussion for later. But for now, in general, it's understood that we will not always agree.
Like your choice of OR music, a bypass should never be performed to the blues.
Warner is a multi-talented man. He's an actor, director, poet, and musician who will also forever be known as Theo Huxtable, Cliff and Claire's only son on The Cosby Show. And depending on how old you are, you actually watched Malcolm grow up right before our eyes through a show that took on serious topics with humor.
You guys, I'm dyslexic.
Malcolm Jamal Warner joined me for a conversation on a Zoom call to talk about The Resident and his enduring career. And the moment he got on screen, I couldn't resist asking him about his lush beard.
It's a beast. Every single take, I take my mask off, then someone comes and picks my beard out, and then someone comes from wardrobe with a lint brush to make sure there's no hair on my ward. It's a whole process, and it happens every single take.
From there, we got down to business. Your character is A.J. Austin, high-powered surgeon, the best at what he does,
yes.
Also kind of a jerk.
Yes.
Attributes I've heard you say you don't allow yourself to be in real life. How fun is it to embody someone who is completely different than yourself?
It's awesome. I think other roles that I've done may have been a little more Malcolm infused, but to play someone who was really, so out of what people are used to seeing me do is really the most fun. You can look at the show and not see Theo.
Absolutely. And do I have this right that before the pandemic, when you all were shooting season 3 of The Resident, you all were actually playing out a storyline very similar to what we're seeing with the pandemic? There was a superbug.
Yeah. Those episodes were conceived and written, long before the COVID-19 pandemic.
Oh.
It was so surreal to watch unfold.
Yeah. This season is really a nod to the hardworking, selfless medical professionals who are really putting themselves and their lives on the line to care for us. I mean, of course, I know you always want to get a character right, but do you feel an extra duty to get this right?
Definitely. For us, it's a wonderful opportunity to shine light and to represent, the healthcare workers and the frontline workers who really are the real life superheroes. And we've been getting wonderfully positive feedback from healthcare workers. I think when you have people in the medical field watching your medical drama and actually like it, mm-hmm. That's always been a big thing for us. But now it's even more so because they're watching a show that fully represents them. The stress, the fatigue, just all of that.
Yeah, it's a moving watch. Well, we know you, as you said, of Theo, of The Cosby Show, but you're also a poet and you're also a musician. And those who came of age at a time in the 90s, like myself, I'll raise my hand. I knew that you were a spoken word artist. But this is something you knew you wanted to do from the time you were like 6 years old?
Yeah. I proclaimed to my parents that I was either going to be a famous actor a famous poet or a famous basketball player. So I got 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
My dad was very proactive in sparking that in me. You know, I was always reading books. He always had me reading poetry books. You know, one of my favorite books growing up was a book called Poems on the Life and Death of Malcolm X.
As a little boy.
Yeah. Well, my father named me after Malcolm X.
Right.
You know, yeah. So he set me up. And I didn't realize it until I was about 15. And I remember calling my dad up saying, dude, you set me up. You know, you can't be named after Malcolm X and Ahmad Jamal and, you know.
Not do something great.
Yeah, thank you.
You're also a bass player, something that you took up as a hobby.
Yeah, it was, you know, that was at a point in my life where the joy for acting had begun to wane. Mm. And I realized I needed a hobby that had nothing to do with acting or directing. So I figured I'm going to pick up an instrument. I'm not going to record any CDs. I'm not going to start a band. I'm not going to be one of those corny actor dudes who want to do music.
There's a band like, on I'm the side. I'm just going to do it.
And then it turned out to be another career.
Yeah. You're actually a Grammy Award winner. You won a Grammy in 2015 for your contribution to Robert Glasper's Experiment's remake of Stevie Wonder's Jesus, Children of America. Let's listen.
Silly songs of laughter in the life after hurt, ego, and misguided pride, which lead to lies the soul can no longer stand to bear. But I see 20 children standing there, beaming bright in angel light as they take flight.
This poem was inspired by the tragedy at Sandy Hook. Can you tell us the story?
I was actually just hanging out with Barbara at the studio, and he's playing me this musical break part of it. He was telling me how one of his buddies was doing a poem about Sandy Hook. And then about 2 weeks later, Robert was back in town. I went back to the studio just to hang out because he was mixing the record now. And he says, listen, you know, my buddy can't do the poem because his buddy's daughter was one of the kids at Sandy Hook. In the 11th hour, it was just too close to home. And Robert asked me if I had a poem about Sandy Hook. I was like, no. I said, but give me the track and I'll go upstairs and I'll write one. You know, about an hour later, he came upstairs and I spit it for him. He was like, that's it. Yeah. So we had no idea. For it to be nominated for a Grammy was one thing, but to actually win, it was a great confirmation or reaffirmation in terms of the artistry and the substance behind the words.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, Malcolm, it occurred to me that the role you play in society as an actor and as a poet and as a musician, I mean, the thing about having this role is that you reflect society back to itself. You know, you remind us of who we are and the potential of what we're capable of. I mean, it's a big reason why Theo Huxtable resonates so deeply with us and the Cosby Show in general, because it was a lightning rod in that regard. I actually consciously remember when I was a young girl thinking, when I have children, I'll be able to show them the Cosby Show because of what it represented. But, you know, now I am a mom, and like most people, I grapple with that. I haven't shown it to them. And that's really painful. Is it painful for you?
It's very surreal. Two things I have to say. On my last album, Selfless, there's a song called Brand New Day.
Mm.
And at the end of that song, I talk about how I'm holding out for that iconic love like Cliff and Claire. So I put that record out September 2015, which was the same month I met my wife.
Oh.
So that's the one thing, like, I've always patterned my love relationships after Cliff and Claire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not Mr. Cosby and Felicia, but Cliff and Claire.
Mm-hmm.
So I watch the show now with my 3-year-old daughter.
You do?
Yeah. She watches the show. As far as she's concerned, the show is called Rudy's Family.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And she
and
knows
you're just like a sidekick to Rudy.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and she knows it's me. She's like, that's Papa, but she wants to see Rudy. But, you know, I watch the show with her, and I completely understand the struggle that some people, you know, have with being able to enjoy the show, you know, in the midst of the present controversy around the show.
With Bill Cosby, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, you know, for me, there's so much that show has done for American culture, for Black culture, for the global perspective of Black people. There's so much of that work that cannot be undone.
Mm. And it was at a time where we did not have, just collectively as a nation, we were all watching three networks, basically. It captured our attention in a way that is universal. Yes. Even beyond race, we as Black folks know what it means for us. But I could sit down and talk with anyone, and they know you, and they know the characters, and they know the storyline. Yes. That's a really powerful legacy. Do you hold that within you in your day-to-day life today?
I think I probably hold it more now. But there definitely have been times that, you know, I've had to be reminded. There was this push and pull, being proud of the show, being proud of being a part of that show. But at the same time, because of its popularity, you know, it also hindered how people, you know, could see me beyond Theo.
Yeah, you wanted to be Malcolm.
Yeah, and I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be able to work and not just be cast in the same type of things or be told no based on what they've watched previously. But the older I get, you know, I go back to that era. I go back to, you know, what the Cosby Show gave to us as a culture. Again, as a Black culture, as an American culture. I hold all of that. And it's a, you know, I'm still proud to be a part of that show. I'm still proud of the legacy. I'm still proud of the timelessness and how much even in 2021, that show is still important and relatable. It's evergreen.
Yeah, it really is. Malcolm Jamal Warner, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Deaf, dumb, blind, halfway out of my mind.
Malcolm Jamal Warner's show, The Resident, airs tonight on Fox. And check out our extended conversation on love and marriage and raising kids. That's at hereandnow.org.
Two big companies in Texas, Dell and American Airlines, have publicly condemned Republican voting bills in that state, and voting rights groups are asking other corporations in Texas to do the same. Advocates are learning from recent fights over voting measures in Georgia. And as we hear from Ashley Lopez of member station KUT in Austin, in a piece that aired on Morning Edition, they want businesses to act before the bills pass.
Cliff Albright is a co-founder of the organization Black Voters Matter. He's been asking corporations to use their money and marketing power to speak out against legislation that makes it harder for people to vote. Albright's group started this project in Georgia,
which eventually led some Georgia companies such as Delta and others to come out, albeit late, to eventually come out and issue strong statements.
What he means by late is that these corporate statements came after Republican lawmakers in Georgia had already passed an overhaul that included some voting restrictions. But Albright says this time they're trying to get ahead of measures in Texas. Already, one major bill has passed in the Texas Senate. The House is still considering its own proposals. Albright says before things move along any further, they're asking big Texas-based companies like AT&T to take a stand against the proposed legislation.
And what we're saying to companies like that and to other companies is that at a minimum, you must, one, stop supporting, stop funding those that are pushing this voter suppression.
In Texas, Republicans have filed a slew of voting bills that would restrict the ability of local election officials to make voting more convenient. The bills would also create new criminal penalties related to voting. Advocates in Texas say these proposals would ultimately make it harder for people of color, new voters, and disabled Texans to vote. Republican State Senator Brian Hughes, a sponsor of one of the bills, says pushback has been overblown.
These are provisions that will apply across the board. Every voter, they're consistent, they're fair, and make it hard to cheat.
But Democrats and voting rights advocates say bills like those in Texas and Georgia amount to a concerted attack on democracy. Latasha Brown, who also co-founded Black Voters Matter, said all members of American society should defend democracy, and that includes businesses.
fundamentally, when we're talking about community, we're talking about businesses, we're talking about organizations, we're talking about individuals. If we are to have a robust and effective democracy that is going to take every aspect of our society to support that.
But Republicans across the country and in Texas say corporations should stay out of this fight. Texas's Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick went as far as to warn CEOs that getting involved in this legislative battle could cost them customers.
You've meddled in a lot of issues lately. I'm not a big believer in boycotts, but people will make up their own minds. Stay out of things you don't know anything about. And if you want to get involved, then you're taking that risk.
During a call with voting groups, former Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke said it's a little ironic that Republicans are telling corporations to stay out of politics after supporting the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, which opened the door to massive corporate spending in elections.
And here you have some responsible corporations trying to ensure that this state does the right thing. And all of a sudden, Dan Patrick and others are up in arms.
Voting rights groups say they're asking a bunch of major Texas companies, including AT&T, Southwest Airlines, Frito-Lay, Valero, and Whole Foods, to publicly oppose the Republican voting bills in the state. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
What's next after workers at that Amazon warehouse in Alabama voted last Friday against forming a union? Well, the retail, wholesale, and department store union that sought to organize them is filing an appeal, and efforts at unionizing Amazon employees elsewhere in the country continue. But how big of a blow to the labor movement was the Alabama workers' rejection of what could have been the first union of Amazon warehouse workers in the U.S.? Jason Del Rey is a senior correspondent at Recode. Jason, some 2,500 workers voted in this union election in Bessemer, Alabama, and the nays outnumbered the yays 2-1. Was this a surprise?
You know, I've covered the company 8 years, and we've never had a vote like this. So I was very skeptical from the beginning that, you know, a union could take hold. No, it wasn't a surprise. There's a reason there's never been a vote like this in Amazon's history. And, you know, we saw that play out.
Well, let's talk about what happened during the vote, because some people point there. First of all, they say that the union should have recognized that these workers did have good pay and kind of worked more towards the other benefits of a union, you know, representation, things like that. But also, they say that Amazon unfairly put their finger on the scale. And that's, in fact, why the union has filed for hearing with the National Labor Relations Board to go over some objections. What are those complaints?
One of the complaints is that Amazon went ahead and pressed the USPS to put a mailbox on the warehouse grounds. To some people, that sounds great for a mail-in vote. And Amazon's claim is we just wanted to make voting easier. The union side, you know, they and some workers who are pro-union say that was, you know, an intimidation tactic. It made some workers believe that Amazon had some hand in either counting the ballots or just surveilling who voted. You know, one of the illegal labor charges that we'll see filed by the union will be related to that mailbox.
Right. Could it have been a place to spy on workers? Amazon also really, you know, went full bore calling in-person mandatory meetings during worker shifts to, you know, stress how bad unions are, saying that, in fact, people would have to spend $500 a year on dues when in Alabama and as in many states, state law is workers don't have to pay union dues and they can still get covered by the union's, you know, representation. So, you know, there were complaints like that. But is there a sense that there may be other ways of going at this idea of pulling workers together?
Yeah. So first, just to be clear, I would expect those charges to be filed. I would expect at least one hearing. And the best case result for the union would be a revote. But we're a long way from that determination. Mm. I've talked to workers or former workers at other facilities, some of whom are trying to organize right now through a union they created called the Amazon Labor Union. There's been reports that the Teamsters are involved in some states, but what some of those local Teamsters reps are saying is, you know, the union election process at a place like Amazon is, you know, it's broken, it's too difficult under current law, and so we're going to try to press for changes in other ways through walkouts, through media attention and the like. So this battle is not over. It just may take a different form.
In other words, they're telling you that they're going to take some of the techniques of the labor movement, you know, protests and such, but not rely on an election.
That's correct.
Yeah. And is there anything else, Jason Del Rey, that union organizers can glean from what happened in Alabama? Some people are saying, well, this isn't just about a drive for unionizing at Amazon. This is a Southern drive for unionizing. Does that make a difference? I mean, what else are people taking from this?
Yeah, I mean, there are for sure some critiques. One is, you know, the facility, you know, that chose to go forward here was one that was only open a year. So, you know, the employees didn't really know each other super well. They didn't have a long standing relationship with the work. So, you know, maybe you want to focus on a place that's been open longer. But yes, you know, their union has sort of tried to describe this also as a civil rights drive. The makeup of the workforce in Alabama, 80 to 85% black employees, according to the union. And, you know, with the pandemic and sort of the racial justice movements across this country, that could have made this, you know, the perfect storm to take on Amazon. But on the other hand, trying to do this in a state like Alabama maybe just was too high of a mountain to climb.
That's Jason Del Rey, senior correspondent at Recode. Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
Over the next week, Here and Now is participating in a global media collaboration to strengthen coverage of climate change. Today's Climate Action Now story looks at sustainable farming. President Biden wants to reward farmers for planting crops that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and use techniques that keep carbon in the soil. Jessica Mazaros from member station WUSF reports on what the business of carbon looks like on one small farm in Florida.
David Kip Ritchie and Angelique Taylor are standing in their one-acre farm off of a busy highway just outside of Tallahassee. Their muddied rubber boots are surrounded by rows of budding mustard greens, collard greens, and kale.
So there's a lot going on in our space. There's an open field of cover crops, a mixture of hairy veg, of ryegrass, also oats.
Ritchie and Taylor established their small-scale farm back in 2017. The couple harvests about 500 pounds of food a year, but they also spend a lot of time and energy evolving their sustainable farming practices.
It's definitely been a roller coaster ride. So it's mainly like researching and then application, and then the application doesn't always go as planned.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency estimates the agriculture sector accounts for 10% of greenhouse gas emissions across the country. Greenhouse gases can be emitted when farmers till the land. The traditional practice of overturning soil when preparing for new crops releases carbon from the soil into the atmosphere. It also destroys the natural ground structure. Ritchie and Taylor use alternatives to tilling. They also plant cover crops in the off-season to keep nutrients in the ground, and they experiment with organic fertilizers to lessen their carbon footprint.
When you practice those things, there's a learning curve, and in that learning curve, that's when you have to sacrifice and you have to say, all right, let me pull back from my profit and let me readjust.
But Ritchie and Taylor are not getting any compensation for this extra effort, and that could soon change. President Biden's administration wants to use $30 billion in farm aid money to pay growers for implementing sustainable practices. And Florida's Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried is totally on board.
It's going to be millions upon millions of dollars.
Fried says farmers have had it hard recently with tariffs, weather, and the coronavirus pandemic. So she thinks this incentive can help.
By giving these types of tools to make additional profits while also saving their land and saving the environment, every farmer across the state of Florida will be eager to see these types of programs coming out and participate in them.
Fried submitted a proposal to the White House that requests a public-private partnership on carbon farming. Some of this is already happening in the Midwest. Private agriculture companies have started paying growers out there for farming sustainably. Bayer is one of them. The pharmaceutical company has a separate crop science arm, which is paying farmers $10 per acre annually for at least one climate-conscious action. Jason Lay has been a grain farmer in central Illinois for 18 years, and he's had 31 fields enrolled in Bayer's program since it launched in August. Lay says adopting new practices is not necessarily more work in the field, but it does require some education.
So a lot of it is just coming to grips with what additional practices you have to become better at.
Lay acknowledges he's not making much off this one program, but for him, it's not about the money. The practices he's adopting are making his soil healthier over time, which is good for business and the environment.
We're going to leave the soil, you know, undisturbed. There's going to be less erosion. It's going to be better water infiltration. We're going to have less chemical runoff, less fertilizer runoff. There's a multitude of things that are more of a long-term part of the solution.
But Lay says farmers, by nature, are very independent, very traditional, and slow to change. David Kip Ritchie and Angelique Taylor say that they're fairly new to farming, so they have no traditions keeping them from learning new methods.
Really, it's the stewardship that drives us to practice these sustainable things.
Yeah, we want to leave something behind for the future generations that come after us.
The couple realize that they have a small operation, but say they're developing practices that can be used on large-scale farms. And funding through public and private programs could be what it takes to get traditional growers on board. For Here and Now, I'm Jessica Mazaros in Quincy, Florida.
Ask anyone who lives in a major city about traffic or public transportation, and you're sure to get an earful. The Biden administration's infrastructure plan calls for $85 billion to modernize public transit and help local agencies expand their systems. That would be a major investment, but it's still less than the roughly $100 billion backlog of repairs that the Department of Transportation says are needed along the nation's bus and rail lines. We're going to take a look now at the needs of one transit agency. Catherine Kellerman is the CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, which serves the Pittsburgh area. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Catherine, am I reading this right? The Pittsburgh area has seen a 70% drop in ridership since the pandemic began. This is huge. How has the pandemic changed or maybe refocused your priorities as a transit system?
Well, I'm sure you have heard it that COVID didn't break anything, but it might have showed us what was broken. So yes, you are seeing that right, that right after the pandemic hit here in Allegheny County, we were down to about 10 to 15% of our passenger levels. But for us in Pittsburgh, 97 of our 98 routes serve either a medical facility or they serve a grocery store. So that 10% has come back to 20 and 30 and in some cases 40 or 50% on routes of people now making trips again, coming back to work. Folks who just don't have the luxury of working from home or making some different arrangements.
I want to talk more about this need, but I want to ask you about the billions of dollars that transit agencies got in emergency relief last year. Now, President Biden's American Jobs Plan calls for new major investments in public transportation. What are your biggest needs right now, and what are you hoping for from the federal government when it comes to this infrastructure spending?
Well, first and foremost, on the American Recovery Plan, the funding which we receive helps us offset losses in other funding. We do not, like some transit agencies, get sales tax. But locally, we have a drink tax, which, of course, has been hit during the pandemic. Over 20% of our budget comes to us via the fare box through user fees. And, of course, that's greatly down now as well. We're also spending significantly more money on sanitation, on PPE. So this funding is critical to help that. But looking forward, I speak for a lot of transit agencies that there is so much unmet demand that it's not just our state of good repair, you know, shelters that were put up in 1983, which need to be updated and replaced, for instance, or rail cars that are older. But as our cities have grown and changed, new neighborhoods have popped up where folks want to take transit and where we can connect better. But we have so much of our resources invested in getting the folks around who really have used us all these years. It's been very difficult to meet that demand. We are very excited to go with electric and clean fuel buses. That's a multi-million dollar investment, for instance. There's so many places where we can take care of our local economies and build local jobs by building more infrastructure.
So The emphasis has really been on meeting the needs of those who desperately need public transit. But do you worry about the people who may have permanently shifted away from it? How are you hoping to win those riders back?
Wow, that is an excellent question. We here in Pittsburgh have run transit since 1859. If you are on Route 91, you are riding the route, which was originally a horse-drawn omnibus over 160 years ago. Now we have an opportunity to refresh, but again, not just for these commuters, for every single person who's been relying on transit. So it is a new world for us.
And thinking about how this infrastructure spending could impact Pittsburgh at large and in this transportation effort, your system has bus routes, light rail lines, a funicular. You've done some capital expansion projects recently, adding electric buses, as you mentioned, replacing old rail cars. And in the long term, you began this 25-year plan last summer that hasn't been finalized, but it could increase services to and from Pittsburgh International Airport. How far would federal funding need to go in realizing these needs?
From a capital perspective, so the things we put in the ground, almost nothing that transit does in the U.S. is possible without getting our tax dollars back from Washington, D.C. It's not just Pittsburgh, it's Tampa, it's Eugene, Oregon, it's Las Cruces, New Mexico. That's how we are funded. I'll tell you, today we have $1 billion that we could spend in capital, and that would just meet our status quo. It's our rail lines date back to the early 1900s. An extension on the busways, maybe $180 million. We will need assistance on that. If we're getting a rail to the airport, if we're getting streetcars in Lawrenceville, if we're putting 24-hour service with good passenger amenities in Penn Hills, all of this requires our investment to be able to come back from Washington, D.C. Public transit nationally, for every dollar that we invest, anywhere from 4 to 6 comes back into your local economy. If you have a dedicated engine that can not just make life better, but can improve your economy, it makes no sense not to make that investment.
Catherine Kellerman is the CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County in Pennsylvania. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.